From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. In Arkansas in 1993, three teenagers were arrested and later convicted in the murder of 3 8-year-old boys. Over the following years, new evidence showed gross errors and misrepresentations by prosecutors in the case that became known as the Memphis Three. An HBO documentary exploring the case brought it to the attention of millions, including celebrities like Pearl Jam's Eddie Vedder, director Peter Jackson, and actor Johnny Depp. In an extraordinary turn of events, the Memphis Three walked free from prison in an unusual agreement that required them to plead guilty and forego suits against law enforcement officials. And one of the Memphis Three, Damian Echols, has written a memoir called Life After Death. And he's with me to talk about the book and his life. And thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's kind of a Seattle connection here. As I read, when you first got out of prison just a little over a year ago, this was one of the first places you came.
Yeah, I got out in the evening one day, and the very next morning we were on a plane on the way to Seattle.
I can't imagine what that was like.
Well, I was still, you know, I'd been in solitary confinement for almost 10 years by that point. So going from that to just being out in the world, I was in a state of extreme shock and trauma. So it was kind of hellish. You know, everybody just expects that you're going to be really excited and happy that you're out, and you are. But there's also, you know, tons of anxiety and just all sorts of stresses that go along with it also.
Has a lot of that receded? Is there some of that still there?
Oh, there's a great deal of it still there, but it does fade as time goes by. You know, the first 3 months or so, it was bad enough that I had to be led around everywhere I went. It does gradually get better. There are occasional times, you know, when I'm not used to dealing with large crowds of people, things like that, when it can be it produces a lot of anxiety, but I am working through it.
Sure.
As time progresses.
I mean, it just seems the exact opposite of solitary confinement to be on a book tour or to be living in New York as you've done.
Exactly. Yes.
It's in solitary confinement. It's been like you were in there for quite a while. You're in prison for a really long time. And in reading accounts of people who've gone through that, I've always kind of wondered where the sort of mental toughness comes from to withstand that without completely losing it. Where did you find it?
For me, it came from two sources. One was my spiritual practice and the other was my wife. By the time I got out, I had worked up to sitting between 5 and 7 hours of meditation a day. Over the years, I was I received Jukai ordination in the Rinzai Zen tradition of Japanese Buddhism, which is the same tradition that used to train the samurai in ancient Japan. And also, there's almost no medical care on death row. They're not going to spend a lot of time and money taking care of someone they plan on killing. So when I would get really sick or be in a lot of pain, the only things I had to turn to were the meditation, Reiki, Qigong, things in that vein, just to preserve my health as much as possible. That and my wife, you know, the way we approached each day was that we're not living for some time in the future when we will be together outside these walls. We're living as if we're together right now. And we sort of built a world for ourselves that we lived in where a lot of times, you know, I wouldn't even think about the prison for days at a time.
Wow. How did you meet your wife? And you also have a child, right?
Yes, my wife and I have been together for about 17 years now. She was a landscape architect in New York, and she saw the original documentary made about the case in 1996 at MoMA. And after she saw it, it had a really profound impact on her, and she sat down and she wrote me a letter. And from the very first letter I ever received from her, I knew this was someone completely and absolutely unlike anyone I'd ever known before.
What was there about what she wrote that made you think that?
I don't think it was exactly what she wrote. It was how she wrote. You know, it made you see the world in a different way. It made you see even the most mundane occurrences as something special, something extraordinary, something magical. And I just wanted more of that. You know, it was exactly what I did need to help preserve my sanity, because it made me want to see the world the way she saw it.
How were you able to connect with your son?
I wasn't really. He's 19 years old now. We tried to keep him as far away from the case and everything about it as we could over the years. And, you know, he's to an age now where he doesn't really need a father figure anymore. I missed his entire childhood. I missed every Christmas, every Thanksgiving, every birthday. So it's really, really hard now for both of us to know, you know, what are we supposed to do? How do we meet up on common ground, and where do we go from here? It's a really difficult situation.
Most of the book, Life After Death, a lot of the book is about what you went through in prison and the difficulties and how hard it is to kind of deal with all of that. But you write, the week leading up to your release was harder than the previous 18 years, which was kind of an amazing statement. Why all of a sudden, with the prospect of finally getting free, was it so much harder?
Well, because we didn't know it was going to happen. We thought it was probably going to happen, but we did not know it was absolutely going to happen until the day that I was out, until that morning when they showed up to get me and take me to the courtroom. For that week, I did not eat. I did not sleep. I couldn't concentrate. I could not do anything except pace two steps back and forth from the door of my cell to the bed. It was a living hell, not knowing if this is going to be snatched away at any moment. And my health had started to deteriorate to get worse and worse over the years. I started to lose my eyesight. I started having a lot of other physical problems. And I knew that I could very well die before another chance came up to get out of prison.
In a statement by one of your co-defendants that he later said was coerced, he said that you were the ringleader in these murders. And I'm just kind of wondering what it was like to know that he had said that and dealing with that.
People ask me a lot, am I angry at him or am I angry about it? And, you know, not really. Not whenever you take into consideration everything surrounding it. This guy had an IQ of between 68 and 72. He was mentally handicapped. And the police picked him up and did what amounts to psychological torture of a mentally handicapped child until they got him to say what they needed him to say. A lot of it, you know, we found out later wasn't even remotely correct. You know, they asked him, what time did the murders occur? And he would say 12 o'clock noon. Well, they knew that wasn't true because all three of the victims were still in school, as well as the guy, Jason Baldwin, who went to trial with me. He was also still in school at the time. So even though they knew what he was saying wasn't accurate, wasn't true, and wasn't correct, it didn't matter to them.
You must have come to that understanding later, but just hearing it at first, hearing that he'd said that, must have been like a slap in the face.
Well, I didn't know the guy really well.
Yeah.
He was just somebody that I would see in the neighborhood. So, you know, the first thing you think is, why would he say that? You know, first I'm thinking, I don't really know this guy. I don't know if he did it or not. But even if he did, why would he be bringing up my name in it? Why would he be, you know, dragging me and Jason Baldwin into the situation? So it really, you don't know how to deal with stuff like that in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, Damien Eccles is my guest. He's written Life After Death about his experiences. He's one of the Memphis Three. You read thousands of books while you were in prison. Were there any that particularly spoke to your situation?
Well, I tried to stay away from anything that was even remotely similar to my situation. People would send me books over the years that they thought I would get some sort of encouragement or inspiration from, and it could have been anything from Nelson Mandela's story to I think there was a book about John McCain and his being a prisoner of war, things like that. To me, that was hellish. That was the last thing on earth I wanted to read, you know, stories about other people in prison. That was everything I wanted away from. For me, it was about just growing as a person. There aren't many opportunities for growth in there at all of any sort. So if you do want to grow, if you want to keep evolving as a person, you have to take it upon yourself to do so. So I would just pick a topic. It could be anything from, you know, the works of Sigmund Freud to the history of the American Civil War, whatever it was. I would just pick a topic and try to exhaust it. As time would go by over the years, I started to lose more and more of my eyesight, and it got harder and harder to read. So I had to narrow my focus and just focus on, once again, the books on meditation, the books on Reiki, the books on Qigong, things that would allow me to preserve as much of my health and sanity as I possibly could until I got out.
It sounds like most of the reading was not escapism, but to escape, to not be where you were.
Exactly.
Yeah. Prison obviously took years from your life. It harmed you physically. It was a huge toll on your mental health. But I'm wondering if there's that old phrase, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Having been so close to that, do you find any truth to that? Was there anything, despite all the horrible things that happened, that you gained from the experience?
Yeah, I don't like that phrase, though, because I don't believe it's necessarily true. Whatever kills you makes you stronger. You know, even the guy who said that, Nietzsche, he was sort of a mama's boy who didn't have a lot of experience in that regard. You know, you can certainly chop off someone's arms and legs, and that's not going to make them any stronger. You know, going through something like this, Yeah, I came out the other side, but I came out the other side damaged in incredibly profound ways, ways that will take me the rest of my life to work on and put back together and try to come out of. But at the same time, it did bring a lot of blessings into my life. You know, I've been married now. My wife and I have been together for 17 years. We wouldn't have met if not for this situation. We've made really dear, close friends that I don't know now what we would have done without. You know, and also, I think the thing, we try to stay away from it. We hate it. We don't like it. But the thing that makes us grow as a person more than anything else in the world is pain. And you certainly have a lot of that in that situation. So it does cause a kind of growth, even though you kind of appreciate it and kind of hate it at the same time.
A part of the agreement of your release, as I understand it, prohibits you from suing the state over the case. Is that right?
Exactly. That was the prosecutor's first question whenever we started working on this deal is, will they sign a waiver saying they give up all rights to sue the state of Arkansas? That was their main concern. You know, once again, people ask me, do I have any second thoughts or regrets or anything about taking the deal? Why didn't I stay and fight it out? And we knew that even with all the evidence that was coming in, the prosecutor could easily drag this case out for another 5 years, another 10 years. They could keep filing for extensions. They could keep asking for delays. They could have kept appealing every single decision that came in. It wasn't like this was close to being over just because the DNA came back. So, I mean, it's either face that or sign this paper and go home within the week. And like I said, my health was already getting really bad. And, you know, they can have you stabbed to death in prison for a pack of cigarettes any day of the week. So I knew one way or another, if not for this deal, I wasn't going to live to see the outside of those walls.
Yeah. I mean, the injustices perpetrated against you and the other members of the Memphis Three. But from looking at your book, you saw what looks to me like a lot of criminal acts committed in prison against you and against others.
Absolutely. You know, over time, you see things in there that just horrify you. There was, you know, one particular instance that I usually talk about is a guy in there that suffered from catatonic schizophrenia, and he would freeze into a position and hold it for hours. He would not move. There would be no sort of response at all, and the guards thought it was funny to sort of make a game of it, to slap him, hit him, push him over to try to see if they could make him move out of that position. To them, he's not even a human being. You know, whenever I first went in, they beat me half to death for 18 straight days. They beat me so bad that I started to urinate blood for a while. And the only reason they didn't kill me is because a deacon from the Catholic Church who heard about it went to the warden and said, I know you're killing this guy, and if you don't stop, I'm going to go public. I'm going to start telling people about it. That's the only reason they didn't kill me. You know, stuff like that goes on in there on a daily basis. Every single time in prison that I was in fear of losing my life, it was never, ever from an inmate. It was from a guard or the administration every single time.
It seems as though just the isolation and the feeling that you're left behind must have weighed heavily on you, at least in the early years. But your case became a huge international case. The HBO documentary about it brought a lot of attention to it. How were you able to understand that being on the inside? Did you kind of get the fact that this case was gaining a lot of momentum on the outside?
It started to happen gradually after 96, whenever the first documentary came out. So I would hear about it. You know, at first it was a trickle, and over time it kept growing and growing and growing. But at the same time, I mean, you know what's going on. You hear about it. You see pictures of people wearing, like, the T-shirts with our mugshots on them, people holding rallies asking for us to be released. But at the same time, you're so busy, caught up in just trying to survive on a day-to-day basis, just trying to live through to the next day, that it doesn't sink into the level that it does to people out in the world who are seeing it.
You conclude life after death by saying that the only way you'll be able to live is if the three of you are exonerated. Can that still happen?
It can, but it's going to be a hard uphill fight. You know, for me, having to talk about this over and over day after day, this isn't fun for me. You know, this is, imagine having the worst thing that's ever happened to you in your life and then having to talk about it every single day. But it's a necessary evil because we don't have a sense of closure, and we won't have until we're exonerated. The person who belongs in prison is in prison, and the people who did this to us are held responsible. And according to the state of Arkansas, this case is closed. They're going to do nothing else on it ever again. So if we want anything done on it, it's up to us to keep doing the investigation, keep pushing, keep talking about the book, keep talking about the documentary, so that they know that we're not just going to give up and go away. We're going to keep fighting until they do what's right.
The documentary produced by Peter Jackson, a lot of people might think they know your story already. This tells them things they don't.
Exactly. And also, it covers a lot of stuff that hasn't been covered before. Our director, Amy Berg, was able to get people to talk to her that have never opened up to anyone else, like the judge, the prosecutor, certain police. They never would talk to any other interviewers, and they talked to her. That, and also, this was the very first time Lori, my wife, and I are producers on this movie. So this was the very first time we've ever gotten to take part in telling our own story. You know, all the other documentaries and TV shows and things were always from someone else's perspective, always from an outside view. And we completely opened our lives up to this documentary in a way that we never have before.
You've become friends with some of the people that took up your case, Pearl Jam's Eddie Vedder. You've called Johnny Depp a brother of yours through this. What do you have in common with them?
I think with Eddie, it was just he used to come see me on death row. You know, he would come there to the prison. It wasn't, you know, everybody involved, from Eddie to Peter Jackson to Johnny Depp, Margaret Cho, Henry Rollins. It's not like they just threw money at the case or made a little speech. I mean, these are people who really did stay involved in you know, Peter Jackson, for example, became part of our legal team on a daily basis. He was involved in legal decisions we were making, experts we were bringing in, raising money for DNA testing. It's an interesting thing. You know, after a while, you don't really see it as celebrity support mm-hmm. anymore. It's just people that have become your friends over the year, people that have been there for you.
Sure. I mean, did you even know them as celebrities when they got to know you? Were you a Pearl Jam fan? Did you know the Peter Jackson films?
I knew the Peter Jackson films because they would show them in prison. You had a charity organization that would come in on like Christmas and Thanksgiving and stuff like that, because tension in prison was so high.
Yeah.
They wanted to lower it a little. So this charity organization would come in and show movies, and they showed the Lord of the Rings movies. I had seen each one of them probably five times before I ever got out. And when they put them on, it would get so quiet in the prison, you could hear a pin drop, because when people are watching them, they're not in prison anymore.
Yeah.
They're going off on this adventure, and people love those things in prison. Pearl Jam were really just starting to kick off their career whenever I went to prison. I can remember seeing the very early videos, you know, things like Even Flow, a very few times before I went to prison. So,
And Johnny Depp?
Johnny, he had been around a little longer. You know, you had movies like Edward Scissorhands and things like that, but he hadn't, you know, exploded to the level that he is now.
Yeah. Well, part of what you've just said and what you say in the book is, I guess at some point you'd like to not be known as one of the Memphis Three. You'd like this to be in your past and to start a new chapter of your life that you would be known for. What would that chapter be for you?
What I would like to eventually do once things die down a little bit, I would like to have – we live in Massachusetts now, and I'd like to have a small meditation center somewhere and be able to share with people the same things that I had to learn in prison that helped me survive, you know, these horrendous circumstances and situations. People that would, you know, want to know these things and use these things in areas of their own lives where they're having really difficult times. So that's really what I would look forward to. To me, that would be an ideal life.
I hope you get it.
Thank you.
Damien Eccles, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
The memoir is called Life After Death, from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Ross Reynolds.